Hey guys, this is Beth Golay. And before we get started with Marginalia, I just wanted to say that KMUW's podcast platform is made possible by High Touch Technologies, a software technology and business communications company that provides products, services, and support to all industries. High Touch brings the human touch to technology with a world-class team of industry experts. Learn more at hightouchtechnologies.com. And now, here's Marginalia.
This is Marginalia, a production of KMUW Wichita.
Marginalia, notes in the margin of a book.
Notes, commentary, and similar material written in the margin of a book.
Comments and notes which are incidental
or additional to
the main topic in the margin of a book.
It's often said that authors should write what they know. David Dow took that advice when he penned the novel Confessions of an Innocent Man. You see, Dow is a law professor and founder of the Texas Innocence Network. He also runs a death penalty clinic and has represented more than 100 inmates on death row. Of those more than 100 incarcerated, he says 7 were wrongfully accused and imprisoned. And that's where fact begins to inform fiction in this book about a man who was arrested, convicted, and incarcerated for his wife's murder and was awaiting execution for a crime he did not commit. I spoke with David Dow last week about the book, his work with death row inmates, good and evil, and a little in between. I'm Beth Golay, this is Marginalia, and here's our conversation. I wouldn't necessarily call this, it is a mystery and it is a thriller, but it is anything from typical. It is not something that, I used to be a bookseller for 13 years, and it's like in a class all its own, I think.
I cannot thank you enough for saying that, because when people call this book a mystery, if people buy mysteries and they buy it because they're mystery buyers, I'm not going to complain about that. But there isn't really a mystery. There's not any question about whether Raphael is innocent, and there's not really any question about whether he's going to avoid being executed, because I completely tip that hand. So when people call it a mystery, I think, well, I just don't know what the definition of mystery is, but a number of people call it that, and I never thought of it that way when I was writing it.
So how much are you spoiling as far as when you're talking on the road now or in the interviews that you've given already? How much are we sharing?
I'm not sharing very much at all. I'm only sharing what you can gather from reading in about the first 10 pages of the book,
which is that there's
a guy, and he's accused of murdering his wife, and you're pretty sure that he's not in prison, although you don't know, you're not 100% positive of that, because you don't know in the prologue who all those people are. But you're pretty sure that the main character is not in prison. But I don't really share much more than that.
So maybe we should talk about some of your history. So you teach law.
I teach law, but I also run a death penalty clinic. Half of my job description is I'm a classroom teacher, and the other half of it is that I run a death penalty clinic. And in the death penalty clinic, my team and I represent death row inmates.
And how many have you represented, or do you represent at a time? I want to kind of talk a little bit about death row, or the death penalty in this country, because I'm trying to even think if I think it's legal in Kansas, but I don't think we've put a person to death since the 60s, if I remember right.
You are correct. I think it's actually more recent than that. Kansas has a death penalty, and it is almost never used. In that respect, Kansas is not really terribly different from most death penalty states, because most states that have a death penalty hardly ever use it. There are only a handful of states that are responsible for almost all of the people who are executed, and for almost all of the people on death row. The answer to your question in terms of the numbers is that I've been doing this for 25 years, and over 25 years, my team and I have represented, I've lost track, but it's pretty well north of 100. It's 110, 115, something like that. Today, on April the 11th, 2019, we have 14 cases on our docket. So there are 14 guys who are currently my clients, and they are at different stages of the process. Some of them are in state court, some of them are in federal court, and some of them are at the stage that we refer to internally as the crisis stage, which means basically that they're at the end of the road and they either already have an execution date or they are at imminent risk of getting an execution date. And all that we do at that point is try to figure out whether there's anything else we can do.
You know, I have two questions at once, and I don't know which one to ask first. So I guess I'll start with, you know, the title of the book is Confessions of an Innocent Man. You know, of all of the people that you either represent or have represented, how many claim they're innocent?
Very few. I've represented seven guys who I believe to be innocent. Two of them we got out of prison altogether. They got off the death row. They walked out of prison. One of them died in prison while we were still working on his appeals. Two of them were executed, and two of them are still alive. So the final chapter of those two stories is not yet written. And so that's a pretty small percentage, obviously. If I've represented 110 people and there's seven guys who I've represented who were innocent, you know, that's just a hair under 7%. I would say that is somewhere on the high end of what most experts think is the number of innocent people on death row. I think that a reliable estimate of the number of people on death row who are innocent is somewhere in the neighborhood of 4 to 9%. But I think that contrary to popular mythology, most guys who are on death row are not claiming that they're innocent, and it's just a myth that everybody on death row says I'm innocent. Almost all of my clients say, I did this, and I'm sorry that I did it, and I wish I hadn't done it.
So this brings me to another question, like the two of yours who you felt were innocent who were executed on death row, how many people are executed when they're still awaiting a decision from a court?
That's a hard question to answer, and let me tell you why.
Does that happen a lot? I mean,
so here's what happens a lot. What happens a lot is that the state will set an execution date while the time for filing a petition to the Supreme Court has not yet expired. So the way things work in federal court is you start at the bottom, which is federal district court, and then you go from federal district court to the United States Court of Appeals. In Texas, it's for the Fifth Circuit. And then once you lose in the Court of Appeals, because obviously you wouldn't be trying to go to the Supreme Court unless you had lost, once you lose in the Court of Appeals, you have to ask the Supreme Court for permission. You can go to the Court of Appeals just by your own volition, but you can't get the Supreme Court to hear your case unless they agree to hear it. And you have 90 days to ask the Supreme Court to hear your case following the day that you lose in the Court of Appeals. And then, of course, once you ask them, in most cases where people ask the Supreme Court to hear their case, the other side doesn't have to respond. In death penalty cases, there's a rule the Supreme Court requires the other side to respond, and then the Supreme Court takes its time and decides whether it's going to hear the case or not. There are some counties in Texas, and I suppose this is true in other states, although I'm not positive about that. There are some counties in Texas who will set an execution date and go forward with an execution during that time period where somebody still has to file that appeal. So there isn't actually anything pending yet, but the reason that there isn't anything pending is because the date for filing what would be pending has not yet gotten here. And there are a whole lot of cases like that. In terms of cases where there's something that has already been filed that is pending and the execution happens anyway, that happens very rarely. It used to happen more often, but it now happens very rarely because the Attorney General has adopted a position that if something is actually pending, then it's not going to move forward with the execution. I'm aware of two cases since I've been doing this work, which is now 25 years. I'm aware of two cases where something was pending, and for whatever reason, the Attorney General went forward anyway. So there's nothing that prevents them from going forward because the warden at the prison is holding what's called an execution warrant, which is an order from a judge to carry out an execution. And until there is some supervening judicial order that says, no, don't do that, the warden has the authority to go forward with the execution. But as a practical matter, the Attorney General advises the warden not to go forward with the execution until all pending litigation has been resolved.
Do you ever... I mean, I'm just you as somebody who runs a death penalty clinic. I'm kind of wondering what kind of a person can return to that type of job day after day after day?
Yes, that's a great question. If I knew the answer to that, then I would not have made hiring decisions in the past that were poor hiring decisions, because I would have known when I was interviewing a young lawyer that this person is going to be destroyed after our first client gets executed, and almost all of our clients get executed. And so I don't know the answer to your question of what makes somebody able to do it. What I do know is that there are some people who are able to do it and there are some people who aren't. And I've obviously over the years supervised, gosh, dozens if not scores of young lawyers working on death penalty cases. And I would say that 8 or 10 of them have been people who, after our first execution of a client in a case that they were working on, came to my office the next day and said, I just can't do this anymore. And I completely understand that, because it's brutal psychologically. You feel like you've got a life of a human being that is entirely dependent on your pulling the right levers, filing the right documents, choosing the right court to file them in, filing them under the precisely correct timing. And there are just a lot of moving parts, and you always have the opportunity after the execution happens to go back and identify 5, 10, 20 things that you could have done differently. And that can just be something that messes up your mind to think, oh, if I had gone left instead of right at this third node on the flow chart, maybe everything would have turned out differently. And if that is the type of mind you have, then you cannot be a death penalty lawyer in Texas, because the volume of cases is such that almost all of your clients are going to be executed and you are going to have a lot of clients. And so in my office, for example, in 2018, we represented 6 guys who had execution warrants. I mean, so that's an execution every other month. Now, it turned out not all those guys got executed. 4 out of the 6 did. But it's just the type of work that can make it really hard to come to the office the next day after you lose one of these things. I don't know what it is that makes some people able to do it and some people not able to do it. All that I know is that, in fact, there are those two different categories of people.
Why do you do it? What keeps you going?
Oh, Lord. I've thought a million times about stopping doing it. And I think that finally the reason that I don't is because I just don't want to abandon my clients. I think that if I ever get to the point that I don't have any more clients on my docket, I'll be able to think seriously about whether I just want to stop taking cases. But I don't know when that'll happen. And right now, as I said, I've got a dozen guys who I represent. I gave a TED talk a few years ago where I said, you tell me the name of somebody on death row and I'll tell you his biography. And the reason that I'm confident that I could do that is because the biography of these guys, 99% of them, they have the same biography. And one of the aspects of that biography is that they were abandoned by somewhere between almost all and all of the people in their lives who are not supposed to abandon you, parents, teachers, siblings, what have you. And I just can't get my head around abandoning these guys who have been abandoned their entire lives. So if I reach the point where there are no more active cases on my docket, then maybe I'll be able to stop doing it, because I won't feel like I'm walking away from somebody. But until that happens, I just feel like I'd be a hypocrite if I stopped working on these cases.
You know, whether it's the inmates, the corrections officers, the police officers, the lawyers, the judges, or anybody, fiction or otherwise, is there really good and evil in everyone?
Yes, and that is what this book is about. We were talking earlier about what section of the library this book should be in, and if people put it in the mystery section, I'm not going to say don't, because I know people buy mysteries. But to me, what this book is about is trying to take apart those categories of good and bad. We have this tendency, as human beings generally, to make little simple diagrams, to draw a line down the paper and put people on one side or the other. And that tendency that we have to do that is, I think, at its height in the criminal justice system. And in the criminal justice system, we have, quote, good guys, and we have, quote, bad guys. Who are the good guys? The good guys are the police, the prosecutors, the judges. Why are they good? They're keeping us all safe. And who are the bad guys? Well, they're the guys who break the law. Why are they bad? Because they're putting us at risk. They're putting us in danger. And so we have the line down the middle of the piece of paper, and we have the good guys and the bad guys. And one of the things that I've learned, and I've been doing this for a long time, one of the things that I've learned is that my clients are somebody who did a bad thing, unquestionably, except for the handful who are innocent. They're somebody who did a bad thing. But then you get to know them, and you realize that these guys who did a bad thing, the worst thing probably that a human being can do, which is to kill somebody else, have all of these other things about them that when we see them in other people, we think of them as good. That is, they have relationships, good relationships with their moms, their dads, their wives or their partners, their sons or their daughters. Lots of my clients have kids. Many of them have talents that are admirable talents. They're good writers. They're good artists. They write music. And conversely, on the other side, the good side, we have these good guys, the police, the prosecutors, the judges, and some of these people have qualities that are simply reprehensible, that when we see them in other people, we think, God, I hope that's not me. They're serial philanderers, they're psychological abusers, they're cheaters, all of these things. And so what I really wanted to play with in the book was this idea that the simple way that we make sense of the criminal justice system by drawing this line down the middle of a piece of paper and dividing the world into good and bad just doesn't hold up when you start to really press on those categories. And I just wanted to see what would happen if I could press on those categories until they collapsed and then try to rebuild them.
You know, there were some of Raphael's, not cellmates, because he was always in a cell alone, but, you know, some of the men that he would meet on death row, they were pretty, I don't want to say charming, but they were so likable. I mean, these guys...
They're extraordinary people. That's just one of the things that I think was so surprising to me as a lawyer when I first started representing these guys. The two characters in the book who I think you're probably referring to, one I call Aguila and one I call Sergeant.
Mm-hmm.
Those guys have characteristics that I put them together in a way that is fiction. I put them together in a way that is a product of my imagination, but the characteristics that they do have are characteristics that my clients have had. You have somebody like Sergeant who has a photographic memory. He's completely uneducated. He quit going to school when he was in eighth grade, but he's a voracious reader, and it reminded me, actually, Beth, when you were saying earlier that you sometimes mispronounce words because you learn words from reading, and that's Sergeant. Sergeant has dropped out of school when he's in eighth grade, and he reads voraciously, and so his vocabulary comes from reading, and he mispronounces a lot of words for that very reason. And then you have Aguila, who is somebody who has come to the United States so that he can make money and send it back to his poor family in Mexico, his poor family that had to flee gang violence, which is why they went back to Mexico. And these are qualities that I think, at least once upon a time in the United States, we really used to admire. But if you put these guys on death row and you say, oh, well, they committed murder, people just tend to not see those qualities. They just blink right by them. And so I really wanted to have those qualities in these guys be very powerful and very present so that you couldn't not appreciate the qualities that they had.
Well, this book, I found it very thought-provoking. It was very literary. It was very, oh, you had some heavy stuff in there. It was so well done. Sorry, what were you going to say?
No, it just makes me so happy when you say that it was literary. Yeah, so somebody asked me a couple of days ago, why'd you choose to write a thriller rather than a literary book? And I said, I didn't. It's not a thriller. It is a literary book. It touches on big themes. It touches on love. It touches on justice. It just so happens that it does all of those things in a context where people are expecting a thriller. And if you want to call it a thriller because you like to read thrillers, I've got no objection to that. But I do think that it's a literary book that is tackling a lot of really big themes.
Well, I agree. I mean, I have book darts throughout this book, and I can't recall when he decided he was not, when he realized, you know, there were some people who realized there's no point in being bitter, and he realized he was not one of them. And I'm like, oh,
yeah,
this is so Monte Cristo. Okay, good.
Yeah. 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 And see, that's me. Yeah, I would have realized it much earlier, obviously. But yes, that's me. The guys who I've represented, I was mentioning earlier that two of my death penalty claims got out of prison, and I don't really have much to do with the day-to-day operations of the Texas Innocence Network that I started almost 20 years ago. It's now run by a woman who's worked for me for a long time, and those are all non-capital cases. But we've also exonerated 6 or 8 or maybe even 10 guys who are in the general prison population. And one of the things that all of them have in common is they get out of prison and they just are so happy to be out, and they just say, I'm going to move on with my life. I'm not going to look backward. I don't have any bitterness. And I would stand behind these guys at press conferences and I would think, wow, I'm not the same species as you, because if I spent 5, 10, 15 years of my life in prison for something that I didn't do, the one thing that I'm positive about is that I would not forget all of the bad stuff that had happened to me on the day that I got out, and I would not forgive the people who had done things that were responsible for my being there. And it's just remarkable to me that these guys who, while they're in prison, we're perfectly happy to think of them as bad guys and to attribute bad motives to everything they do. And then the day they get exonerated, the day they get out of prison, the day society realizes, oh, wow, they're not bad guys after all, they're good guys, we all of a sudden have huge admiration for these qualities of forgiveness and forbearance, that if we had noticed those qualities while they were still in prison, while they were still bad guys, they wouldn't have even registered. And now they get out of prison, they're exonerated, they say, I'm just going to move on with my life, I'm not bitter, and we say, wow, what a remarkable person. And I just have realized time and time and time and time again that if I were in that position, I would just not be somebody who said, I'm going to let bygones be bygones. I would feel like somebody had taken something from me and somebody needs to pay for that.
That was David Dow, author of the book, Confessions of an Innocent Man, which was published by Dutton. Thanks for joining us for Marginalia. Discover more episodes at KMUW.org or wherever you get your podcasts. Marginalia is produced at KMUW Wichita. Our engineers are Mark Statzer and Torin Anderson. Our editors are Luann Stevens and Haley Krausen, and I am the producer. This is Marginalia, and for KMUW, I'm Beth Golay.